and that one thing has only one opposite.
I say so.
So which of our statements shall we give up, Protagoras, that one thing has only one opposite, or the earlier one, where we said wisdom is distinct from moderation, each being a part of virtue, and that besides being distinct, they and their powers are unlike, like the parts of a face?
Which shall we give up?
For neither statement sits well together. They don't harmonize or fit with one another.
How could they, if it's necessary that one thing has only one opposite and no more?
And yet folly, being one thing, appears to have both wisdom and moderation as its opposite.
Isn't that so, Protagoras, I said, or is it otherwise?
He agreed, and very reluctantly.
So moderation and wisdom would be one thing.
And earlier it appeared to us that justice and piety were nearly the same thing too.
Come now, Protagoras, I said, let's not grow weary but examine what remains as well.
Does it seem to you that an unjust man is being moderate, in that he acts unjustly?
I would be ashamed, Socrates, he said, to admit that, though many people do say so.
Shall I direct my argument to them, then, I said, or to you?
If you like, he said, argue first against that popular view.
It makes no difference to me, so long as you're the one answering, whether or not you actually believe it, for it's the argument itself I'm chiefly examining, though it may turn out that both I who ask and the one who answers are being examined too.
At first Protagoras put on airs about this, claiming the question was awkward, but then he agreed to answer.
Come then, I said, answer me from the start.
Does it seem to you that some people are moderate while acting unjustly?
Granted, he said.
And you mean by being moderate, thinking well?
He agreed.
And thinking well means planning well, in that they act unjustly.
Granted, he said.
Is that, I asked, if they fare well by acting unjustly, or if they fare badly?
If well.
Do you mean, then, that there are certain good things?
I do.
Are these, I said, the things that are beneficial to people?
And by Zeus, he said, even if they're not beneficial to people, I still call them good.
And it seemed to me that Protagoras was already growing irritated and anxious, and had braced himself against answering.
Seeing him in that state, I proceeded carefully and asked gently,
"Do you mean, I said, Protagoras, things that are beneficial to no one at all, or things not beneficial in any way whatsoever?
And do you call such things good?"
"Not at all," he said.
"But I know of many things that are of no benefit to people, foods, drinks, medicines, and countless others, while some are beneficial, and some are neither good nor bad for people, but are for horses, and some only for cattle, others for dogs, and some are good for none of these but for trees.
And some things are good for a tree's roots but bad for its shoots.
For instance, manure, which is good for the roots of every plant when spread there. But if you tried applying it to the young shoots and fresh branches, it destroys everything.
Or take olive oil. It's thoroughly bad for all plants, and the worst enemy of the hair of every creature except a human being's, though for human hair and for the rest of the human body it's a help.
So good is such a varied and multiform thing that here too what's good for the outside of a person's body is, for the inside, the very worst thing there is, which is why doctors all forbid the sick from using oil except in the smallest amount, just enough in the dishes they're about to eat to quench the unpleasantness that comes from the smells through the nostrils, in the food and the side dishes.
When he'd said this, those present burst into applause at how well he'd spoken, and I said, "Protagoras, I happen to be a rather forgetful sort of person, and if someone speaks to me at length, I lose track of what the argument was about.
So just as, if I happen to be a bit deaf, you'd think you ought to speak louder to me than to others if you meant to converse with me, so now too, since you've run into a forgetful man, Cut your answers shorter and make them briefer if I'm to keep up with you.
How short do you want me to make my answers then?
Shorter than they need to be.
By no means, I said.
As long as they need to be.
He said.
Yes, I said.
Then shall I answer with as much as seems to me needed, or with as much as seems needed to you?
I've heard, I said, that you're able both to teach someone else and to speak yourself at length on the same subjects, going on as long as you like without ever running out of things to say, and also, on the other hand, so briefly that no one could outdo you in fewer words.
So if you're going to discuss things with me, use the other method on me, the short one.
Socrates, he said, I've entered into contests of speech with many people before now, and if I did what you're asking, discuss things the way my opponent told me to, I wouldn't have come out looking better than anyone else, and Protagoras would never have made a name for himself among the Greeks.
And I could see that he wasn't happy with his earlier answers, and that he wouldn't willingly go on discussing things by way of answering questions, thought it was no longer my business to stay for these conversations, and said,
Well, Protagoras, I myself am not eager to force our discussion to run against your wishes.
Once you're willing to discuss things in a way I can keep up with, I'll discuss them with you.
You, after all, as people say of you and as you say yourself, are capable of carrying on a conversation both at length and briefly. You're a wise man, but I'm no good at these long stretches, though I wish I were capable of it.
It should really have been you who gave way to us, since you can do both, so that our discussion might actually happen.
But as it is, since you're not willing, and I have some business to attend to and couldn't stay with you while you stretch out long speeches, I have to go somewhere, I'm off, though I dare say I wouldn't have minded listening to that too.
And with these words I got up to leave, and as I was rising Callias caught hold of my hand with his right hand, and with his left took hold of this cloak of mine and said,
We won't let you go, Socrates.
If you leave, our discussions won't be the same.
So I beg you to stay with us. There's no one I'd rather listen to than you and Protagoras talking together.
Do us all this favor.
And I said I was already on my feet, on my way out, son of Hipponicus. I've always admired your love of wisdom, and I do so now too, and I'm fond of you, so that I'd like to do you this favor, if what you're asking of me were possible.
But as it stands, it's just as if you were asking me to keep pace with Crison of Hymra, the runner in his prime, or to run alongside one of the long-distance runners or the day runners and keep up with them.
I'd tell you that I need far more than you do to keep up with runners like that, but I simply can't. And if you want to watch Crison and me running the same race, ask him to slow down to my pace, since I can't run fast, though he can run slow.
So if you're eager to hear both me and Protagoras, ask him to answer now the way he answered at first, briefly, and to the point of the questions.
Otherwise, what will become of our conversations?
I always thought that talking things over together with one another was one thing, and making speeches to a crowd was something else.
But you see,
he said, Socrates, Protagoras seems to me to be making a fair claim, that he should be allowed to discuss things his way, and you yours.
Then Alcibiades broke in, That's not well said, Callias.
Socrates here admits he has no share of the long speech style, and yields the point to Protagoras. But as for being able to hold a discussion, and knowing how to give and take an argument, I'd be amazed if he yielded that to anyone alive.
Now if Protagoras admits he's worse than Socrates at discussion, that's enough for Socrates. But if he claims otherwise, let him discuss by asking and answering, not stretching a long speech out over each question, dodging the arguments and refusing to give an account, but drawing things out until most of the listeners have forgotten what the question was even about. Though I can vouch that Socrates won't forget, whatever jokes he makes about being forgetful. So it seems to me Socrates has the more reasonable position. Everyone ought to state his own view. After Alcibiades, I think it was Critias who spoke. Prodicus, Hippias, Callias here seems to me very much on Protagoras' side, while Alcibiades is always eager to win at whatever he takes up. But there's no need for us to take sides eagerly with either Socrates or Protagoras. Let's rather ask them both together not to break up our gathering. When he had said this, Prodicus said, I think you're right, Critias. Those of us present at discussions like these ought to be common listeners to both parties in the discussion, but not give them equal shares. That's not the same thing. We should listen to both together, but not divide our attention equally, giving more to the wiser one and less to the less learned. For my part, Protagoras and Socrates, I ask you both to allow each other to dispute your positions, but not to quarrel, for friends dispute with friends out of goodwill, while it's rivals and enemies who quarrel with one another, and this way our gathering would turn out at its best. You, the speakers, would in this way earn genuine regard from us, the listeners, rather than mere praise, for genuine regard exists in the minds of listeners without deception, while praise is often spoken in words that belie one's real judgment, out of pretense. And we, the listeners, would in this way take the greatest delight, rather than mere pleasure, for delight comes from learning something and having a share in understanding, through the mind itself. While pleasure comes from eating something or experiencing some other bodily gratification. When Prodicus said this, a good many of those present showed strong approval. After Prodicus, Hippias the wise spoke. Gentlemen here present, he said, I consider all of you kinsmen, relations, and fellow citizens by nature, not by custom. For like is akin to like by nature, while custom, a tyrant over mankind, forces much that goes against nature. It would be shameful, then, for us, who know the nature of things, and who are the wisest of the Greeks, and who have gathered for just this purpose here in the very council hall of wisdom in Greece, and in this city's greatest and most splendid house, to show nothing worthy of that reputation, but instead to squabble with one another like the most common of men. I too ask you, Protagoras and Socrates, and I advise you, to come to an agreement, as though we here were arbitrators bringing you to a middle ground, that you, Socrates, should not insist on this overly exact, clipped style of discussion, if it isn't to Protagoras' liking, but should let the reins out and slacken them for the arguments, so that they may appear to us grander and more graceful. And that you, Protagoras, in turn, should not let out every sail and run before a following wind, fleeing into the open sea of speeches until land is out of sight, but that both of you should cut a middle course. So do this, and let me persuade you to choose a referee, an overseer, a chairman, who will keep watch over the proper length of each of your speeches. This pleased those present, and everyone approved, and Callias said he wouldn't let me go, and they asked us to choose a chairman. I said, though, that it would be shameful to choose a judge over our arguments. For if the one chosen turns out to be worse than we are, it wouldn't be right for the worse to oversee the better. And if he's our equal, that's no better either, being our equal. He'll do just as we would, so the choice would be pointless. Well then, you'll choose someone better than us. But in truth, I think, it's impossible for you to choose anyone wiser than Protagoras here. And if you choose someone no better, yet claim that he is, that too is shameful to him, as though you were setting a chairman over some ordinary fellow, though for my own part it makes no difference to me. But here's what I'm willing to do, so that the gathering and our discussions may proceed as you're eager for. If Protagoras doesn't want to answer, let him ask the questions and I'll answer. And at the same time, I'll try to show him how I say the one answering ought to answer. And once I've answered as many questions as he wants to ask, let him in turn give me an account in the same way. And if he doesn't seem willing to answer the very question asked, then both you and I together will beg him, just as you've begged me, not to spoil our gathering, and there's no need for a single chairman for this. All of you together can oversee it." Everyone agreed this should be done, and though Protagoras was quite unwilling, still he was compelled to agree to ask questions, and once he had asked enough, to give an account in turn, answering briefly, point by point. So he began questioning me something like this. "I think, Socrates," he said, "that the greatest part of a man's education is being skilled about poetry, that is, being able to understand what the poets say, what's composed correctly and what isn't, and to know how to analyze it and give an account when asked. And in fact, my question now will be about the very thing you and I are now discussing, virtue, only transposed into poetry. That will be the only difference. Simonides, you see, says somewhere to Scopas, the son of Creon of Thessaly, that it's truly hard for a man to become good, foursquare in hands and feet and mind, made without blame. Do you know this poem, or shall I go through the whole of it for you?" And I said there was no need, I knew it, and in fact I'd given it a good deal of attention. "Good," he said. "Then does it seem to you well and correctly composed, or not?" "Quite," I said, "both well and correctly." "And does it seem to you well composed, if the poet contradicts himself?" "Not well," I said. "Look more closely then," he said. "But my good man, I've considered it enough." "Then you know," he said, "that further along in the poem he says, 'Nor does Pittacus' saying ring true to me, though spoken by a wise man. He said it's hard to be noble.' Do you notice that this is the same person saying both this and what came before?" "I know it," I said. "Does it seem to you then," he said, "that this agrees with that?" "It seems so to me, at least, though at the same time I was afraid he might be onto something. But," I said, "doesn't it seem so to you? How could it seem that the same man agrees with himself, when he's the one who says both things, who first assumed himself that it's hard for a man to become truly good, and then a little further on in the poem forgets this, and finds fault with Pittacus for saying the very same thing he himself said, that it's hard to be noble, and refuses to accept it from him, though Pittacus is saying the same thing as he is. Yet whenever he finds fault with a man for saying the same thing he himself says, clearly he's finding fault with himself too, so that either his first or his second statement must be wrong." When he'd said this, he caused a great stir and drew praise from many of the listeners. And I, at first, as though struck by a skilled boxer, went dark and dizzy at his words and the others' clamor of approval. Then, to tell you the truth, so as to gain myself some time to think over what the poet meant, I turned to Prodicus, and calling out to him said, "Prodicus, Simonides is after all your fellow citizen. It's only right that you come to the man's defense. So I think I ought to call on you, the way Homer says the river Scamander, under siege from Achilles, called on the Simois, saying, 'Dear brother, let the two of us together hold back this man's strength.' And so I'm calling on you too, so that Protagoras doesn't sack Simonides on us. Because setting Simonides right really does need your special skill in words, the one that separates wanting from desiring, as if they weren't the same thing, along with all those fine points you just made. So think it over now and see whether you agree with me about this. It doesn't look to me as though Simonides contradicts himself at all. But first, Prodicus, tell us your own view. Do you think coming to be and being are the same thing or different?" "Different by Zeus," said Prodicus. "Well then," I said, "in the opening lines Simonides declared his own opinion, that it's hard for a man to truly come to be good." "True," said Prodicus. "And he criticizes Pittacus," I went on, "not as Protagoras thinks, for saying the same thing he himself says, but for saying something different. Pittacus wasn't claiming that this hard thing was to come to be good, the way Simonides does, but to remain so. And being and coming to be, Protagoras, are not the same thing, as our friend Prodicus here says. And if being isn't the same as coming to be, then Simonides doesn't contradict himself. Prodicus here and plenty of others would probably say, following Hesiod, that coming to be good is hard since the gods set sweat in front of virtue, but that once a man reaches its peak, then it becomes easy to hold, hard as it was to gain. When Prodicus heard this, he praised me for it, but Protagoras said, "Your correction, Socrates, contains a bigger mistake than the one you're correcting." And I said, "Then it seems I've done real harm, Protagoras, and I'm some kind of ridiculous doctor. Treating the disease only makes it worse." "That's exactly how it is," he said.
"How so?"
I asked. "It would show great ignorance on the poet's part," he said, "if he really thought possessing virtue was such a trivial thing, when it's the hardest thing of all, as everyone agrees." And I said, "By Zeus, how well timed it is that Prodicus here has joined our conversation. His wisdom, Protagoras, is very likely something ancient and divine, going back to Simonides or even further. You, though experienced in so many things, seem to be inexperienced in this one, unlike me, who has some experience, being a student of Prodicus here. And now it seems to me you're missing the point that Simonides may not have meant hard, the way you take it, but rather the way Prodicus here is always correcting me about the word terrible, whenever I praise you or someone else by calling them terribly wise. He asks whether I'm not ashamed to call good things terrible. Because terrible, he says, means bad after all. No one ever speaks of terrible wealth or terrible peace or terrible health, but of terrible sickness and terrible war and terrible poverty, since the terrible is something bad. Perhaps, then, the scenes in Simonides also take hard to mean something bad, or something else you're missing. Let's ask Prodicus. It's only right to consult him about Simonides' own language. Prodicus, what did Simonides mean by hard?
Bad, he said.
So that's why he criticizes Pittacus, I said, for saying it's hard to be good as if he'd heard him say it's bad to be good. What else do you suppose Simonides meant, Socrates, he said, except to rebuke Pittacus for not knowing how to properly distinguish words, being a lesbian raised speaking a foreign dialect?
You hear that, Protagoras?
I said, do you have anything to say to it? And Protagoras said, that's far from how it is, Prodicus. I'm quite certain Simonides meant by hard just what the rest of us mean, not bad, but whatever isn't easy, whatever takes a great deal of effort to achieve. And I think so too, Protagoras, I said, and that Prodicus here knows it as well, but is joking and testing whether you can defend your own reading. Because the very next line is strong proof that Simonides doesn't mean hard as bad. He says, only a god could hold that privilege. Surely he isn't saying it's bad to be good, and then that only a god could have this, granting that privilege to a god alone. That would make Simonides out to be some kind of reckless fool, and no scene at all. But let me tell you what I think Simonides really has in mind in this poem, if you'd like to test how well I handle this business of verses, or, if you prefer, I'll listen to you instead. Protagoras, hearing this, said, as you like, Socrates. And Prodicus and Hippias both urged me on eagerly, and so did the rest. Very well, I said, let me try to go through with you what I think about this poem. Philosophy among the Greeks is oldest and most widespread in Crete and Sparta, and that's also where you find the greatest number of sophists on earth, but they deny it and put on a show of ignorance, so that it won't be obvious they surpass the rest of Greece in wisdom, the very sort Protagoras described as sophists. Instead, they want to seem to surpass others through fighting and courage, thinking that if their real advantage were known, everyone would train in that instead, namely, wisdom. As it is, by concealing that, they've fooled the Spartan imitators in the various cities, who bruise their ears trying to look like them, wrap their hands in straps, take up hard exercise, and wear short cloaks, as if it were by these means that the Spartans dominate Greece. But the Spartans themselves, whenever they want to mix freely with their own sophists and grow tired of meeting them in secret, expel all these Spartan imitators along with any other foreigner staying in the city, a purge of foreigners, and then meet with their sophists without the foreigners knowing. And they themselves let none of their young men travel to other cities, just as the Cretans don't either, so they won't unlearn what they've been taught at home. And in these cities it isn't only the men who take great pride in their education, but the women too. You can tell I'm speaking the truth, and that the Spartans are extremely well trained in philosophy and argument this way. If anyone cares to engage even the most ordinary Spartan in conversation, he'll find him, for much of the exchange, seeming rather plain, but then, at some point in the discussion, he'll throw in a remark worth hearing, brief and tightly wound, like a skilled javelin thrower, so that whoever's talking with him looks no better than a child. This is exactly what some people today, and some in the past, have grasped, that being Spartan is far more a matter of loving wisdom than of loving exercise, knowing that the ability to utter such sayings belongs to a fully educated man. Among these were Thales of Miletus, Pittacus of Mytilene, Bias of Priene, our own Solon, Cleobulus of Lindos, and Myson of Chen, and a seventh was counted among them, the Spartan Chilon. All of these were admirers, lovers, and students of the Spartan education, and one can recognize their wisdom by its character, brief, memorable sayings, each attributed to one of them. Meeting together, they dedicated the first fruits of their wisdom to Apollo at his temple in Delphi, inscribing there what everyone now repeats: know yourself and nothing in excess. Why am I telling you all this? Because this was the ancient style of philosophy, a kind of Spartan brevity of speech, and one saying of Pittacus's in particular circulated privately, praised by the wise, that it is hard to be good. Now Simonides, being ambitious for a reputation in wisdom, realized that if he could bring down this saying, like taking down a celebrated athlete, and get the better of it, he himself would gain fame among the people of his time. So it was against this very saying, and for this very purpose, that setting a trap for it he composed this whole poem, or so it seems to me. Let's examine it together, all of us, and see if what I say is true. Right at the start of the poem it would look like madness if, wanting to say that becoming a good man is hard, he then threw in the word men. This doesn't seem to fit into the sentence at all for any purpose, unless one takes Simonides to be speaking as though disputing with Pittacus's saying. With Pittacus saying it's hard to be good, Simonides answers, disputing him, "No, rather, to come to be a truly good man is hard, Pittacus. Not good in truth," as if he meant that some men are truly good while others are good but not truly so. That would seem a silly thing to say, and not worthy of Simonides. Rather, we need to place the word truly out of its normal order in the poem, treating Pittacus's saying as something said first, with Simonides answering it as if we set it up with Pittacus speaking and Simonides replying, "Men, it is hard to be good," and the reply, "Pittacus, that isn't true, for it isn't being but coming to be, a man good in hands and feet and mind, formed foursquare, without a flaw, this is truly hard." In this way, it's clear both that the word men fits the sentence, and that truly is correctly placed at the end. And everything that follows bears this out, that it was meant this way. There's much that could be shown about how well each part of the poem is composed. It really is crafted with great care and skill, but it would take too long to go through it all that way. Let's go through its overall shape and intent instead, since it is, more than anything else, a refutation of Pittacus's saying throughout the whole poem. He says, a little further on, as though continuing the argument,
that to truly become a good man is hard, though possible, for a certain time. But having become so, to remain in that state and be a good man, as you claim, Pittacus, is impossible and beyond human reach. Only a god could hold that privilege. A man cannot help but be bad when ruinous misfortune brings him down. Now who does ruinous misfortune bring down when it comes to steering a ship? Clearly not the ordinary man, he's already down. Just as one couldn't knock down someone already lying flat, but could knock down someone standing to make him fall, while someone already down cannot be made to fall further, so too ruinous misfortune could bring down a resourceful man, but not one who is always without resource. A great storm striking a helmsman could leave him helpless, and a harsh season striking a farmer could leave him helpless, and the same for a doctor. For it's possible for the good man to become bad, as another poet also testifies, saying, "A good man is sometimes bad, sometimes good." But it isn't possible for the bad man to become bad, he must always be so. So that when ruinous misfortune brings down the resourceful, wise, and good man, he cannot help but be bad. But you, Pittacus, say it's hard to be good when really, to become good is hard, though possible, while to remain so is impossible. For every man is good who fares well, bad if he fares badly. So what activity is good with respect to letters, and what makes a man good at letters? Clearly, learning them. And what good performance makes a good doctor? Clearly, learning the treatment of the sick. But bad performance makes a bad one. Who then could become a bad doctor? Clearly, someone who is first a doctor at all, and then a good doctor since he could also become a bad one, while we who have no knowledge of medicine could never, however badly we perform, become doctors or carpenters or anything else of that sort, by our bad performance. And whoever could not become a doctor by performing badly clearly could not become a bad doctor either. In just the same way, a good man might at some point also become bad, whether through time, or hardship, or illness, or some other misfortune, for this is the only bad performance there is, to be stripped of knowledge, but a bad man could never become bad since he already is bad. Rather, if he is going to become bad, he must first have become good. So this part of the poem, too, points to the same thing, that it is not possible to be a good man, remaining good all the way through, but it is possible to become good and likewise to become bad, this very same man, and that those are best for the longest time whom the gods love. All this, then, is said with Pittacus in mind, and what follows in the poem makes it even clearer. For he says, "Therefore I will never, in search of what cannot be, cast away my portion of life on an empty, unattainable hope, a man entirely blameless, among all of us who harvest the fruit of the wide earth. If I find him, I will report it to you," so he says. This is how vehemently, and throughout the whole poem, he keeps pressing against Pittacus's saying, "But I praise and love all who do nothing shameful, willingly. Against necessity not even the gods make war." And this too is said with the same point in mind. For Simonides was not so uneducated as to say that he praises those who do no wrong willingly, as though there were some people who do wrong on purpose. I am fairly sure of this much, that none of the wise men thinks any human being errs willingly, or willingly does shameful and bad things rather. They know well that all who do shameful and bad things do so unwillingly. And Simonides, too, does not say he is a praiser of whoever does no wrong willingly. He is speaking about himself when he uses the word, willingly. For he thought that a fine and good man often forces himself to become someone's friend, and to love and praise a friend, as, for instance, a man often finds himself with a strange mother or father, or a homeland, or something else of that kind. Now when something like this happens to base men, they seem almost glad of it, and point it out, blaming and denouncing the baseness of their parents or their homeland, so that people will not reproach them or blame them for neglecting these, and will not reproach them for neglecting them, so that they end up blaming them even more, and adding voluntary hostilities on top of the one's necessity imposed. But good men cover the matter up and force themselves to praise it, and if they are angered at their parents or homeland for some wrong done to them, they console themselves and reconcile, forcing themselves to love and praise their own. And I think Simonides himself often thought it right to praise and extol some tyrant or other such person, not willingly, but under compulsion. This, then, is what he says to Pittacus as well. Pittacus, it is not for this that I blame you, that I am fond of blame, since, he says, it is enough for me if a man is not bad, nor overly helpless, and knows justice that benefits the city, being a sound man. I will not find fault with him, for I am not fond of fault-finding, since the tribe of fools is endless. All things, indeed, are fine in which nothing shameful is mixed. He does not mean this the way one might mean it by saying, all things are white in which no black is mixed. That would be absurd in many ways, but that he himself accepts what is middling too, so as not to find fault. And I do not seek, he says, a man entirely blameless among all of us who harvest the fruit of the wide earth. If I find him, I will report it to you. So on that score I will praise no one, but it is enough for me if a man is middling and does nothing bad. I love and praise all such men. And here he uses the dialect of the Mytileneans, since he is speaking to Pittacus, saying, but all I praise and love, willingly, whoever does nothing shameful. Here one must divide the sentence at the word, willingly, when reading it, but there are some I praise and love unwillingly. You then, Pittacus, even if you had spoken things that were only moderately fair and true, I would never have found fault with you. But as it is, you speak great falsehoods about the most important matters while seeming to speak the truth, and for this I do find fault with you. This, Prodicus and Protagoras, is what I take it Simonides had in mind in composing this poem. And Hippias said, you too, Socrates, seem to me to have gone through the poem well, but I also have an account of it that I think is good, which I will show you if you wish. And Alcibiades said, yes, Hippias, another time. For now it is only fair that Protagoras and Socrates keep to what they agreed between themselves, that if Protagoras still wants to ask questions, Socrates should answer. But if he wants to answer Socrates, then he should let the other one ask. And I said, I leave it to Protagoras to choose whichever he prefers. But if he's willing, let's set aside poems and verses, and let me gladly go on with you, Protagoras, to the end of the question I first asked you. For discussing poetry seems to me altogether too much like the drinking parties of ordinary, common people. Such people, because they are uneducated and cannot keep each other company over their wine through their own voices and their own words, put a high price on flute girls, hiring the borrowed voice of the flutes at great expense, and keep each other company through their voices. But where the drinkers are fine, good, and educated men, you would see neither flute girls nor dancing girls nor harp girls, but people content to keep each other company by themselves, through their own voices, speaking and listening to one another in turn and in good order, even if they drink a great deal of wine. In just this way, gatherings like ours, if they happen to involve men such as most of us claim to be, have no need of a borrowed voice, nor of poets, whom one cannot even question about what they mean. And when people bring them into their arguments, some say the poet meant this, others that, arguing about a matter they are unable to settle. But such gatherings as those, let them go their way, and let us keep each other's company ourselves, through our own words, putting one another to the test in our own arguments and being tested in turn. It seems to me you and I ought rather to imitate men of that sort, setting the poets aside and conducting our discussion through ourselves, with ourselves,
testing the truth and testing each other. If you still want to ask questions, I am ready to offer myself to you and answer. Or if you prefer, you can offer yourself to me and let us bring to a conclusion what we broke off discussing partway through. When I said this, and other things of the kind, Protagoras still would not make clear which of the two he would do. So Alcibiades, looking toward Callias, said, "Callias, do you think Protagoras is behaving well right now, refusing to make clear whether he will engage in discussion or not? I don't think so. Either let him converse, or say that he does not wish to converse, so that we may all understand this about him, and Socrates can converse with someone else, or whoever else wants to, with someone else." And Protagoras, apparently ashamed at Alcibiades saying this, and at Callias's pleading and at nearly everyone else present, was reluctantly persuaded to engage in discussion, and told me to ask him questions, since he would answer. So I said, "Protagoras, do not think that in conversing with you I want anything other than to examine closely the very things I myself am regularly at a loss about. For I think Homer says something quite true. When two go together, one notices before the other. Somehow all of us human beings are more resourceful for every deed and word and thought when we work together. But if a man notices something alone, he goes about at once looking for someone to show it to and confirm it with, until he finds someone. That is why I, for this very reason, would rather talk with you than with anyone else, since I think you would examine best, along with the other things a reasonable person is likely to consider, the matter of virtue as well. For who else if not you? Since you not only think yourself a fine and good man, as some others do who are decent themselves, but cannot make others so. But you yourself are good, and are able to make others good as well, and you have such confidence in yourself that, while others hide this skill, you openly proclaim yourself before all the Greeks, calling yourself a sophist, and have declared yourself a teacher of education and virtue, the first to think it right to charge a fee for this. How then could I not call on you to examine these matters and question you and share my thoughts with you? There is no way I could not. And now I want again, from the beginning, to recall some of what I first asked you about these matters and to examine the rest together with you. The question was, as I recall, this: wisdom and self-control and courage and justice and piety, are these five names for one and the same thing? Or does each of these names have its own distinct reality and thing underlying it, each having its own power, one not being like the other? You said, then, that they are not names for one thing, but that each of these names applies to its own distinct thing, and that all of these are parts of virtue, not the way the parts of gold are alike to one another, and to the whole of which they are parts, but the way the parts of a face are unlike the whole of which they are parts, and unlike one another, each having its own particular power. If this is still how it seems to you, as it did then, say so. But if you now hold some other view, define it, since I will not hold you to anything. In case you now say something different, for I would not be surprised if you were only testing me when you said that before. But I tell you, Socrates, he said, that all these are parts of virtue, and that four of them are fairly close to one another, but courage is very different from all the rest. You will know that I speak the truth this way. You will find many men who are extremely unjust, and impious, and intemperate, and ignorant, yet outstandingly courageous. Hold on, I said, it's worth examining what you're saying. Do you mean by the courageous those who are bold, or something else? Yes, he said, and ready to go where most people are afraid to go. Well then, you say virtue is a fine thing, and it is as something fine that you offer yourself as its teacher. The finest thing there is, he said, unless I'm mad. Then is part of it shameful and part fine, I said, or is it fine as a whole? Fine as a whole, as much as anything could be, he said. Do you know who dives into wells without fear?
I do, divers.
Because they know how, or for some other reason.
Because they know how.
And who are bold about fighting from horseback, riders or people who can't ride?
Riders.
And who about fighting with a light shield, men trained with shields or those without?
The trained ones.
And in fact, if that's what you're after, all the rest follows the same way. Those who know are bolder than those who don't, and are bolder than they themselves were before they learned. But have you ever seen people with no knowledge of any of these things who were nonetheless bold in the face of them?
I have, he said, extremely bold.
Well then, are these bold people also brave?
That would make courage a shameful thing, he said, since these people are simply mad.
Then what do you mean by the brave?
Aren't they the bold ones?
Yes, even now, he said.
Then aren't these people, bold as they are, clearly not brave but mad?
And over there, the wisest are also the boldest, and being boldest, the bravest, and by this reasoning wisdom would be courage.
You're not remembering correctly, Socrates, what I said and answered.
When you asked me whether the brave are bold, I agreed.
But whether the bold are brave, you never asked me. If you had asked me then, I would have said not all of them.
And you haven't shown anywhere that my admission that the brave are bold was wrong.
Next, you point out that those who know are bolder than they were themselves, and bolder than others who don't know. And from this, you think courage and wisdom are the same thing.
Going about it that way, you might as well conclude that strength is wisdom.
First, if you question me this way, whether the strong are capable, I would say yes.
Then, whether those who know how to wrestle are more capable than those who don't, both compared to others and to themselves before and after learning, I would say yes.
And once I'd agreed to that, you could use the very same evidence to claim that, by my own admission, wisdom is strength.
But I never anywhere, not even there, admitted that the capable are strong, only that the strong are capable.
For being capable and being strong are not the same.
The one, capability, can come from knowledge, but also from madness and passion, while strength comes from nature and the proper nourishment of the body.
In the same way, boldness and courage are not the same either.
So it follows that the brave are bold, but not all the bold are brave, since boldness can come to people from skill, but also from passion and from madness, just like capability, whereas courage comes from nature and the proper nourishment of the soul.
Now, Protagoras, I said, you say some people live well and others badly.
He agreed.
Do you think a person would live well if he lived in distress and pain?
He said no.
And what if someone lived his life pleasantly and then died?
Wouldn't you say he had lived well in that case?
I would, he said.
So living pleasantly is good, and living unpleasantly is bad.
Only, he said, if one takes pleasure in honorable things.
What do you mean, Protagoras?
Surely you're not, like most people, calling certain pleasant things bad and certain painful things good.
I mean this. Aren't things good, insofar as they are pleasant, precisely on that account, apart from whatever else may come of them?
And likewise, aren't painful things bad simply insofar as they are painful?
I don't know, Socrates, he said, whether I should answer as simply as you put it, that all pleasant things are good and all painful things bad.
It seems safer to me, not only for my answer today but for my whole life, to say that some pleasant things are not good, and some painful things are not bad, while others are as you say, and there's a third class that is neither bad nor good.
And by pleasant, I said, you mean things that share in pleasure or produce pleasure.
Exactly, he said.
Then this is what I'm asking. Insofar as they are pleasant, are they not good? That is pleasure itself not good? "As you always put it, Socrates," he said, "let's examine the matter itself, and if the inquiry seems reasonable and the same thing turns out to be both pleasant and good, we'll agree. If not, then we'll dispute it."
"Well then," I said, "do you want to lead the inquiry or shall I?"
"You should lead," he said, "since you're the one who started the argument."
"Might it become clear to us this way," I said, "as if someone, examining a man for his health or for some other bodily function, having seen only his face and hands, said, 'Come, uncover your chest and back too and show me, so I can look more closely. That's the sort of thing I want for our inquiry. Having seen how you stand regarding the good and the pleasant, as you say, I need you to reveal something further of your thinking. How do you stand regarding knowledge? Do you think about it the way most people do, or differently?"
"Most people think something like this about knowledge, that it isn't strong or fit to lead or rule. They don't even conceive of it as being that kind of thing at all. Instead, though knowledge is often present in a person, they think it's not knowledge that rules him but something else. Sometimes passion, sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain, sometimes love, often fear, treating knowledge quite literally as if it were a slave, dragged around by all these other things. Is that how it seems to you too? Or do you think knowledge is a fine thing, capable of ruling a person, so that if someone knows what's good and bad, nothing could overpower him into acting otherwise than knowledge commands, but that understanding is sufficient to come to a person's aid?
It does seem that way to me, Socrates," he said, "just as you put it, and besides, if it would be shameful for anyone to deny that wisdom and knowledge are the strongest of human things, it would be especially shameful for me."
"Well said and truly said," I replied. "But you know that most people don't believe you and me. They say that many who know the best course won't act on it, even though they could, but do something else instead. And whenever I've asked people what accounts for this, they say that those who act this way are overcome by pleasure or pain, or ruled by one of the things I just mentioned."
"Yes," he said, "Socrates, and I think people are wrong about a good many other things too.
Come then, join me in trying to persuade people, and teach them what this experience actually is that they call being overcome by pleasures, on account of which they fail to do what is best even though they know it.
Perhaps if we told them, 'You're not speaking correctly, friends, you're mistaken,' they might ask us, 'Protagoras and Socrates, if this isn't being overcome by pleasure, then what is it, and what do you two say it is?
Tell us.'
Why must we consider the opinion of the many, Socrates, who say whatever comes into their heads?
I think, I said, this will help us discover something about courage, and how it relates to the other parts of virtue.
So if you're willing to stick with what we just agreed, let me lead in the direction I think will make things clearest, follow me. But if you'd rather not, and it suits you, I'll let it go."
"No," he said, "you're right, carry on as you began."
"Well then," I said, "suppose they asked us again, 'What do you claim this thing is, then, that we called being weaker than pleasures?'
I would answer them like this, 'Listen, Protagoras, and I will try to explain it to you. Isn't this what you mean, friends, when you say this happens to you? Often, overpowered by food or drink or sex, pleasant as they are, you do these things even while knowing they're bad.'
They would say yes.
Then wouldn't you and I ask them again, 'In what way do you say these things are bad?'
Because they give this pleasure right now, in the moment, and each of them is pleasant, or because later on they cause diseases and poverty and bring about many other such troubles.
Or even if none of that followed later, and all they did was give pleasure, would they still be bad simply because they make one feel pleasure in whatever way?
Don't we suppose, Protagoras, they would answer anything other than that these things are bad not on account of the pleasure they produce in the moment, but because of what comes later, the diseases and the rest?
I think, said Protagoras, that most people would answer that way.
And doesn't causing disease cause pain? And doesn't causing poverty cause pain?
They would agree, I think.
Protagoras agreed. So it appears, friends, as Protagoras and I would say, that these things are bad for no other reason than that they end in pain and deprive you of other pleasures.
Would they agree?
We both thought so.
And then, in turn, if we ask them the opposite question,
friends, you who say that painful things can be good, don't you mean things like this? Physical training and military campaigns and medical treatments involving cauterizing and cutting and drugs and starvation diets, that these are good, yet painful?
They would say yes.
Do you call these things good because, in the moment, they cause the most extreme pains and sufferings, or because afterward health results from them, and physical fitness, and the safety of cities and power and wealth for others?
They would say the latter, I think.
We both thought so.
And are these things good for any reason other than that they end in pleasures, and in the relief and avoidance of pain?
Or can you name some other end you have in view when you call them good, besides pleasures and pains?
I don't think they could, Protagoras said.
So then you pursue pleasure as a good, and avoid pain as an evil.
We both thought so.
So this, then, is what you consider bad, pain, and this, pleasure, good, since you even call the very experience of enjoying something bad, whenever it deprives you of greater pleasures than it contains, or brings about greater pains than the pleasures within it.
For if you called enjoyment itself bad on some other ground, looking to some other end, you could tell us, but you won't be able to.
Nor do I think they could, said Protagoras.
Isn't the same true, in turn, of feeling pain?
You call the experience of pain itself good whenever it removes greater pains than it contains, or brings about greater pleasures than the pains involve.
For if you're looking to some other end when you call the experience of pain itself good, other than what I've described, you could tell us, but you won't be able to.
That's true, said Protagoras.
Well then, I said, if you ask me in turn, friends, why do you go on about this at such length and in so many ways, forgive me, I would say.
First, it isn't easy to show what this thing is that you call being overcome by pleasures. And second, the whole argument depends on it.
But you can still take it back, even now, if you have some other way of saying what the good is besides pleasure, or what the bad is besides pain.
Or is it enough for you that a life be lived pleasantly, without pains?
If that's enough, and you have nothing else to call good or bad that doesn't come down to this in the end, then hear what follows.
I say that, given this, your account becomes absurd whenever you claim that a person, knowing that certain things are bad, does them anyway, when he need not, because he's driven and overwhelmed by pleasures. And then again you say that a person, knowing the good things, isn't willing to do them because of the immediate pleasures, being overpowered by them.
How absurd this is will become obvious if we stop using so many names at once, pleasant and painful, good and bad. And since these turned out to be really two things, call them by two names only. First good and bad, and then, separately, pleasant and painful.
Having settled that, let's say, a person, knowing that bad things are bad, does them anyway.
If someone then asks us why, we'll say, because he's overcome.
Overcome by what, he'll ask us in turn.
We can no longer say, by pleasure, since good has taken over the name that pleasure used to have.
So we answer him and say, overcome.
By what, he'll say?
By the good, we'll say, by Zeus.
Now if the one questioning us happens to be a rude sort, he'll laugh and say, what an absurd thing you're saying if someone does bad things, knowing they're bad when he needn't do them, because he's overcome by good things.
Is it, he'll ask, because the good things in you aren't worth beating the bad ones, or because they are worth it?
Will obviously answer that they aren't worth it. Otherwise, the man, we say, is weaker than his pleasures wouldn't have gone wrong. And in what respect, he'll perhaps ask, are the good things not worth as much as the bad, or the bad not worth as much as the good? Is it anything other than this? That one set is bigger and the other smaller, or one more numerous and the other less? We won't be able to say anything else. So clearly, he'll say, what you mean by being overcome is taking greater bad things in exchange for lesser good ones. So much for that. Let's take the names back again, pleasant and painful applied to these same things, and say, a person does what we before called the bad things, but now let's call them the painful things, knowing they're painful, overcome by the pleasant things, which clearly aren't worth prevailing. And what other lack of worth could pleasure have against pain, except an excess or a deficiency relative to each other? These come down to being bigger and smaller than each other, more and less, greater and lesser. For if someone says, but Socrates, the pleasure right now is very different from the pleasant or painful that comes later in time, I would say, different in what other respect than pleasure and pain? There's nothing else it could be. Rather, like a good man weighing things, put the pleasant things together and the painful things together, and set the near and the far on the scale, and tell me which are more. If you weigh pleasant things against pleasant things, always take the bigger and more numerous. If painful against painful, take the fewer and smaller. If you weigh pleasant against painful, and the painful is exceeded by the pleasant, whether the near by the far or the far by the near, then that's the action to perform. But if the pleasant is exceeded by the painful, it's not to be performed. Isn't that how it is, my friends? I would say, could things be otherwise? I know they couldn't say anything else. And Protagoras agreed too. Since this is so, I'll say, answer me this. Do the same sizes appear to your eyes bigger from up close and smaller from far away, or not? They'll say yes. And the same for thickness and number. And do equal sounds seem louder up close and fainter from far off? They'd agree. Now if our doing well in life depended on this, on taking and doing the things of great length and size, and avoiding and not doing the small ones, what would we find as our life's salvation? Would it be the art of measurement or the power of appearance? Wouldn't the latter make us wander and flip back and forth, often changing our minds about the same things and regretting our actions and choices among the large and small, while measurement would strip that appearance of its power, and by revealing the truth would let the soul rest quietly on what's true, and so save our life? Would people agree, faced with this, that it's the art of measurement that would save us, or some other art? They agreed, the art of measurement.